You're listening to Japan Baseball Weekly. News, interviews, analysis, and hot takes about all 12 NPB teams. Hosted by Jim Allen and John E. Gibson.
Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly podcast. It's for the week of October 24th. I'm John Gibson, and with me on a Japan Series opening weekend is my partner, Jim Allen. How are you, dude? You tired?
I'm savoring a five-hour, three-minute game and thinking how lucky we are that it started a quarter past six instead of 6:30.
6:30, yes. Thank you. The precious time. I remember tweeting Jason Koskri, our buddy, during the game and saying, hey, man, we're recording tonight, so any precious seconds we can save. And boy, did that tweet come back to bite me in the fingers.
That word bites you. I know where it bites me, but okay. All right. Well, usually people just say my tweets bite, and I then leave it at that.
Well, yes. Yeah, I'm one of those persons. So, yes.
Hashtag hi.
All right. On this week's show, we've got two Japan Series games to discuss. We're going to look at the draft and handle some high heat. So let's start swinging.
Clearing the bases!
All right, so let's get right into the Japan Series. We had a 12-inning marathon game with no winner tonight, so that just pushed back our recording time. But, you know, I've got lots of energy. I'm happy. I love baseball. Whatever I have to tell myself to push through the night here. But let's start with game one on Saturday. Yes. Game one, the Swallows win 5-3. They open strong, and I think I kind of expected them to start that way at home. But the news of the night was Japan ace Yoshinobu Yamamoto of Oryx, who left the mound in kind of an odd way. And you know that I hate this, and I really have to ask somebody what this is all about. But why pitchers signal to the bench when they are in discomfort instead of walking over to the bench or walking toward the bench while they make that signal? Or why does somebody have to come and pick them up? So I promise this offseason I will get to the bottom of this. But Yamamoto motions to the dugout in the fifth inning, and he has some problem, some discomfort. And, you know, he wasn't all that sharp. He wasn't completely sharp, as you could probably tell by the fact that he had allowed a two-run double off the third base bag in the first inning. That was Jose Osuna, and then solo home runs to Osuna and Yasutaka Yoshiomi. And he just didn't look like himself. And then he got two strikes on Patrick Hevlahan, and then he puts his arm up and he leaves the game. And they said it was for precautionary reasons, that there was a pain in his left rib cage or our side.
Oblique,
wherever you want to say it, it's nebulous kind of a term in Japanese anyway. So, but I had concern about him coming back for game six. I hadn't seen any reports. I have not seen any reports saying that he wasn't necessarily going to start game six. But had you seen anything? Had you heard anything?
Nope.
Okay. All right. So what was your impression from this game?
Well, it was almost like, that's weird, because my preview that I put out, I think Friday morning or Thursday night, said kind of like predicted Oryx is going to get a bunch of runners on bases, but going to have trouble getting enough hits that they can turn them into lots of runs. And the Swallows are going to strike out a lot. And if anybody hits home runs, it's going to be the Swallows. And that will give them an edge in their home games, because the home games this year are being played at Jingu. The Swallows' home games are played at Jingu. Last year, the Swallows' home games were played at Tokyo Dome, so they didn't get that little extra advantage that the power...
In the Japan Series, yes.
That's correct.
Yes. So, yes. I had forgotten about that until they showed the highlights of it, and I'm like, oh, that's right.
That's right. They had the, I think they had the, because of the Olympics, they had a month off, and they had, I think it was almost a month off, and the series went late when the college, the university championship was scheduled to be played at Jingu.
And they said, sorry, Charlie. Yeah, take a hike, buds.
That's right. It's not your stadium. We're not, who do you think you are, MLB or something? We didn't do this work.
Right. So, yeah, I didn't think, like I said, Yamamoto was all that sharp, and it was kind of shocking to see, but shocking but not surprising in that it's Jingu. So if you make mistakes in the middle of the plate, which the home run to Osuna was, the pitch to Shiomi was, even though he meaning Yamamoto, kind of shook his head like he couldn't believe that ball went out. But when you see the replays and you can see the trajectory, that thing was not going to stay anywhere near that park. So I don't know what he was shaking his head about. But
it was a cutter that probably needed some more time being sharpened.
It kind of floated up there,
and Jose Osuna was all over that puppy.
So he didn't look right, and of course. The Buffaloes had pitches to hit, and I kept looking at the pitches that they missed, and I thought that was a cookie. You guys, you know, you're making crumbs, but you got to eat the whole cookie. You know, you can't just break it at the plate there and let it crumble. And that's the way the cookie crumbled. But anyway, they did not hit some pitches that were juicy and that were right there in the middle of the plate on a number of times, and they let Yasuhiro Ryan Ogawa off the hook. That's what I took away from this game as well.
Yeah. Well, that was the thing. I mean, he had lots of chances to get out of innings. And after one tough batter in the first inning, but after that, he had just had trouble throwing strikes, and he's behind everybody, and that's at least in the second inning, and then he kind of rebounded and got stung in the fifth again when he didn't give up any didn't give up any runs, but that was
got into big trouble.
That was really the story. And of course the fifth inning, you know, he gave up a single, a triple, a walk and hit batsman, but no runs.
Yeah, that's a high wire magic trick.
There was a lot of that, but that's sort of what, you know, I saw this coming. You know, be a little to some, not like I had a my crystal ball or anything, but this is the kind of result like I expected from these two teams, where essentially the Buffaloes scored three runs on 10 hits and a zillion walks, and the Swallows scored three runs on three swings, and then they got a fluke double.
Yeah, that thing off the bag there. And I kept rewinding that to watch it again. I kept saying, wasn't that foul? And then you could barely see it hit the third base bag,
right?
The bell by Osuna, and in the first inning. And yeah, go ahead.
It's possible that it was foul, but I think it's highly unlikely, just because for it to have been foul, it would have had to bounce on the dirt outside the bag, and then bounce toward the bag and off the bag, because it bounced away from the bag. So I find that unlikely. I mean, it's not impossible. You see balls that have enough weird spin on them that they'll bounce. I mean,
well, here's
I ragged on him, Bob Davidson, once a couple of years ago. I don't know if he's out of umpiring now, but he called one a couple of years ago, which was a ball that had weird English on it, and it bounced a foot foul and spun fair. And it was a fair ball, and it rolled inside the third base bag, but he's the third base umpire, and he called it foul. And he said, no, runner, go back to the plate. That's a foul ball. Because it was Bob Davidson.
That's as good a reason.
I only remember that because I wasn't that clear on the rules, and I went and checked. Oh, I see it. It can bounce foul.
It can bounce back into fair ground, it's touched and foul. My point on that was that the umpire is close enough to the bag, and I'm sure it would have made some kind of a ticking noise that he could hear, that because they don't let the fans make a lot of noise. I'm pretty sure it hit the bag, because he was adamant about it being fair, and it did change direction. So I was pretty, I mean, I, like I said,
yeah,
at first,
that's I kept why I said, it. Yeah, that's why right. I said it was likely. I mean, it's not impossible, but sure. I think it was likely.
Sure. And then we did have Munetaka Murakami hit a home run in the Japan series, his first of the Japan series, obviously in game one. That was later in the ninth inning. And it just seemed to me that the Swallows looked very much, much like the better team, especially, you know, knocking Oryx's best pitcher, not, I wouldn't say around, but they hit him fairly well on a night when Ogawa was, like I said, missing location in the zone. And I thought it was maybe perhaps an omen because of Murakami taking Yoshihisa Hirano deep in the ninth inning. I couldn't figure out why Hirano was out there in kind of a mop-up situation. And as it turned out, they didn't even have him. I don't know how you – he wasn't active for the game.
He wasn't activated for game two, no. Well, they here's the thing. They have a 40-man roster for the Japan series. Mm-hmm. And they're basically can activate 25 on any day. There's no delay. 25 guys can – they can deactivate 15 guys on one day if they like.
Mm-hmm. So he was not activated for game two after giving him that home run. And they didn't really miss him, although we'll get to game two here. But the other thing that I noticed and that I wanted to comment on was Oryx slugger Yutaro Sugimoto, who really looked completely off his game early on in the series. And he was coming off a fairly good climax series. And I just had the impression he was just flailing and hoping the bat would somehow make contact with the ball because he came up in some big situations and it just looked like he had no chance of making any kind of contact and that you didn't even have to watch the at-bats because it was going to end in a very predictable outcome. And so I didn't think he looked good, but he bounced back a little bit in game two. So I was glad to see that, but he did look awful early on.
Yeah, I wasn't, I didn't have... Actually, he was one of the guys, as you said, he did well in the climax series. And I thought I had expectations that he would look more like the 2021 guy.
Mm.
And although Murakami's been kind of about normal Murakami, as opposed to, you know, killer
monster.
Murakami.
Yeah,
monster Murakami and dead weight Murakami. although even saying that, that in September when he hit, I think he hit 183 or something in September, he still was on base 350 on base percentage and a 420 slugging average. So that's what you call your dead weight Murakami.
Yeah, because so people, yeah, when they did want to pitch to him, you know, he didn't get hits, but they didn't really want to pitch to him. So
yeah, so and then so he's yeah. That's about where he is now. So
yeah. All right, so let's move on to this game tonight. And, you know, we are in a really good situation for as far as JBW is concerned because we had the series end last week and we were able to do a preview and talk about the teams that were actually going to be in the world, the Japan series, instead of having to guess like we normally do. And we were really set up for if this series was kind of short, maybe six games, that we would be able to finish it on Saturday, this Saturday coming, and be able to talk about it and wrap everything up on Sunday and not have to sweat through another game here on Sunday night, this coming Sunday. But we had a tie tonight, a 3-3, 12-inning tie. And as Jim mentioned earlier, 5 hours and 3 minutes of glorious baseball. Mm. And Yako comes away with the series lead with a 1-0-1 record. And they have the series lead. And so first, I want you to talk about I think somebody tweeted it out about the last time we had a tie and what that does to the series. And now we have a game eight in which there is no innings limitation. So what does this do?
Well, you just said it. Unlike the poorly named climax series. Well, I mean, poorly named because it's the quarterfinals and the semifinals of the Japan series. So, I mean, it's like,
it's pretty much,
let's call it. Yeah, let's call the American League and National League playoffs the epitome of the season and then just have this afterthought World Series afterward.
It's a premature climax series.
Exactly, premature. Yeah, it's as I used to say, premature speculation. Anyway, so the difference is that in the Japan series, it's not the team that wins the most out of 7 or 8 or 9. It's the first team to 4, which means essentially this thing could potentially go to, okay, now there are no tie games after game 7. That's the good thing. So it doesn't go on like a W.P. Kinsella novel where, you know, the game goes on forever until generations pass. So we don't have that, but it could mean, let's say that this series goes to game 8, finish game 7, and it's tied 1-1 with 5 ties.
And it's the first team to 4 wins, so see you tomorrow, boys.
That's right. It could go conceivably to game 12.
No,
that's the worst. That's the worst case scenario, or the best case scenario. I know people who really like baseball who would that would be very cool. But I don't want to be the one who has to write and blog the whole time.
Cool and cruel at the same time. I think that is a daunting task for fans to go through what they went through tonight. I mean, you and I are just observers. Of course, you are a fan of the Swallows. I prefer the Central League over the Pacific League, but I like the Buffaloes. I root for them. I want to see them do well. And I understand fandom. That's the other thing, because I am one. And that is torture. You cannot go through, you know, 3 or 4 tie games, you know, and have, especially what we had tonight. So let's get to tonight's game, talk about that, and then we'll go on about this future of the series. So the Buffalo scored 2 runs in the 3rd and 1 in the 5th. Then the Swallows only scored in 1 inning, and that was the 9th inning, and they had 11 fruitless attempts in which they got guys on or hit balls toward the outfield and did not score. So 11 innings, they didn't score. Both teams used 8 pitchers each. So with a day between games, we've got a day off on Monday. It was a pretty amazing game to go into that day off, the travel day. They're going to go down to Kyoto, set up Dome, Osaka, and play 3 down there. So I think the only thing you could question in this game about either manager's moves, if as far as I was looking at it, this is my opinion. The only thing I would question is that having Shota Abe, a guy, and you heard the setup. I don't know if you had the volume on or not on the TV. I did switch over to TV to watch the extra innings portions, and you hear the announcer saying, Shota Abe, he's the closer now for the Oryx Buffaloes. This guy pitched 6 years in the corporate leagues, finally got drafted. He's 29-year-old, essentially a rookie. He's in his second year, but he's essentially a rookie. And here he is pitching in the Japan series. And they said all this as, you know, he was warming up in the bullpen and went out to the mound. And I thought, you know, that's a bad setup, man. And I don't believe in any of these jinx garbage or anything like that, because nothing anyone says or does can ever impact anything that happens on the field. The only ones who can impact it are the players. But I thought, man, this setup is a setup for a setback. And that's really what happened, because he didn't get either any of the first 3 guys out. And the 3rd guy, Soma.
Well, he tried his best against the first one.
And, you know, I before we went on, Mike, I said, I looked at him. And it wasn't that he was not throwing good pitches. It just that it would just seem like he wasn't himself, and he was tight, and he wasn't throwing his usual pitches. Now, we haven't seen much of him, so it's hard to know exactly what he looks like in all situations or in many situations. But this particular night, I could tell something was different. And I guess just being, he looked like a guy who had never pitched in this situation, you know, no postseason experience pitching in a, and yet he had pitched in the Climax series, but this is the Japan series. Everybody's watching, and he just looked a little tight. And then when he missed badly with a pitch, it was Soma Uchiyama who just jumped all over it. And then announcers again were talking about, well, this is a really good hitting catcher. You've got to be careful with him and blah, blah, blah. And then bang, he hits a home run, ties the score. And after that, Abe almost gave up the walk-off home run, but it only went near the warning track.
Warning and then track, he got, man.
Yeah, Yeah, and then he got out of the inning, and we end in a 3-3 tie. So what was your big takeaway from this game?
I don't know, too many takeaways. Again, same thing. I mean, both teams had a jillion runners on base. And the Buffaloes got their three runs kind of, you know, it's funny because it was my original story for tonight was, you know, the Buffaloes had no trouble early in the game putting good swings on pitches in the zone.
Mm-hmm.
But basically when the runs came in, it was sort of like roll the dice and hit roll sevens because, well, the first one was going to score because of where he hit it. It didn't have to be a single. When Sachiya Yamasaki, the Oryx starting pitcher, hit a bouncer past the drawn in infield. Okay, if they're playing back, there's going to be an out at first base, but a run's still going to score. Okay, I'll give him that one.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second run wouldn't have scored because, oh, hold on. Now, the second run would have scored as well, but it was on an error. And then the third one was an excuse me single. An excuse me two out infield single because the third baseman was respecting Yutaro Sugimoto's power and playing 15 feet behind third base, and he dribbled it down the third baseline. So the runner scored from third. So that was the Oryx's luck. So there was that luck.
Okay, well, hang on. You're saying excuse me on the Sugimoto swing, and I thought that I rewound it like three or four times to see what was going on.
Okay.
And it was an outside pitch. It was a breaking ball breaking down and away, and somehow he was able to reach out and pull that ball to the – I mean, normally if you try to hit anything, you're just going to foul that thing off, foul it back, poke it down the first baseline, or – do what he did, hit roll some kind of a weak ball. Yeah, roll over it and hit some kind of a weak ball. But, I mean, he really had to reach for it, and yet he was trying to pull it, which I couldn't understand.
Mm.
But when I looked at it slowly, you see him really do a good job of just making contact with that pitch and getting it and trying to pull it.
Yeah.
And I think that's what saved him. So when you say excuse me,
it was a fluke single.
Okay, I thought you definitely. But yeah, I mean, a pitch he shouldn't have been trying to pull, shouldn't have been trying to swing at. He does swing at it and he does pull it and he ends up with a base hit and an RBI. So yeah, I get you. All right.
Yeah,
all
it was
right.
Like, yeah,
so they scratched out these runs is what you're saying in the end.
Yeah, they got
the Swallows earned theirs.
Well, then there's the thing, of course. So there was that luck, and it was pretty much okay. The Buffaloes are leading by three, but it's close. You know, they were close to not scoring at all. And, you know, I mean, that's the way it goes. They had plenty of runners. And when you get that many runners on in one inning, somebody's going to score.
Yeah. And they were also close to blowing it out when they had the bases loaded and some good players coming up to bat and they couldn't get anyone. Yeah.
Sure. And Cy Snead started the first inning and he looked like Cy Snead, like he did in the summertime when, you know, in the second inning, he started getting behind everybody. And then and that was the other thing I predicted in my Japan series forecast was that Oryx would they'd foul off a lot of pitches and run up guys' pitch counts and put strikes in play because the Swallows generally throw strikes and they're good at that. Mm-hmm. They just probably wouldn't do enough of it. So anyway, so there was that, and we get to the game inning, and we've already described the three run ninth. Jacob Wagesback was really, he pretty much, he came close to ending the game in the bottom of the eighth inning when he gave up two little scratch singles up the middle. And then with two outs, he threw some pitches that really, he probably wished he had them back before they got to the plate.
Mm.
Domingo Santana missed at a 3-1 pitch that was the people on TV. Kazuhiro Wada was like going, shame on you. And Hideki Nagaoka missed on another of those. And I think that was a 2-1 pitch that he missed on. And it was another big, big straight pitch. I mean, he threw some other ones, but they were better. He did throw some good fastballs in those counts, but he got out of it by, he walked to Santana and then he struck out. But both of those, he threw those two pitches that had three run home run written all over them. And so he got out of, they got away with that. And then of course they didn't get away with the ninth. And of course the Swallows had their luck because they didn't win this game. They didn't tie this game without a huge amount of luck in the 12th inning.
Yeah. Now you and I sent messages and short messages on phone, and I thought this run was going to count as a wild pitch, and I was busy tweeting, and then I heard the announcer saying one base, and I look up and I'm like, what's going on? That, you know, the guy was halfway to home plate when things went down here. I know that they gave us the really good angle on TV, and you could see him rounding third, and that he really never stopped. Mm-hmm. He kept coming, and I couldn't figure it out. So I messaged you right away, and I'm like, what is going on? And then I rewound the thing, and I'm looking at it, and the catcher, was not Uchiyama at the time.
No, it was Yuhei Nakamura.
Okay, Nakamura was running toward the bench where this wild pitch went. Basically, there's a door there, right? You and I have gone through that door many times to go onto the field, and the ball got lost in there. But Nakamura's reaction time to not being able to see the ball, and from the time that it actually disappeared into this cove that is back there.
Yeah, he started looking around. He's like looking for the umpire to signal fair catch.
But Right. And so that's what threw me off, because he didn't really react. And so I said, well, this the runner Sano is halfway to home plate. You can't just put your hand up because, you know.
Yeah, his reaction
was just late.
Yeah, if he had when the ball disappeared,
if he had put his hand up right away, it would have been what the umpires were calling.
Well, when the ball got away from Nakamura, he was plenty of the way to third when he just started coasting up and I'm going to stop. And then as soon as he saw where it was rolling and Nakamura turned the wrong way, he's going like, oh man, no way he's going to get that ball because it was going to that corner.
Right, Sano did slow down, but he didn't stop. Yeah,
he didn't stop, but it slowed down enough that it took him. He got to third base just after the ball rolled off the field of play, and the umpire said, "Sorry, son. If you were two steps farther along, you would have scored."
So, yeah, they talk about the baseball being a game of inches, and those really the inches in foul territory and the inches around third base are not the ones they're basically talking about all the time.
Because as a runner. If that ball stays in play, there's no way in hell they're going to be able to throw him out.
Yeah, and so they have the lead at that point. Now, who knows what would have happened in the ninth because situations change, but they would have at least had a lead and opportunity to get it. And that was all with two outs and nobody on, and they got that little mini rally going. So it was unfortunate for them, and they couldn't come through with a hit. So we ended up with that tie. So yeah, I mean, it was a fun game for sure. I can't say that I wish it had gone reverse. I wish we would have had a nice 5-3 tidy game on Sunday and a 12 inning game that didn't force us to start recording at midnight here, but it was still a fun game, and I'm looking forward to the series because, like you said earlier, and I think we predicted when we talked last week, these teams are very close, and I don't really anticipate any one side blowing the other out. You might be able to get lucky a couple times in a row and pull those games out, but Oryx, I think, is behind it, though, because they're under the gun. They're going to have to win a game. They basically didn't win a game here in Tokyo, and they're going to have to.
Yeah, I expect they're going to win two of the games in the Kyocera Dome.
Well, this is the other thing. Well, they better, because I think, I'm sorry to cut you out, but I think, because I was trying to figure out why Sachiya Yamasaki, not a guy I've spoken highly of. In fact, probably this season I probably said some negative things about him. I mean, he's not a marginal pitcher. He's just not a great pitcher. And he's a high traffic pitcher. He is inconsistent. But he was really at the top of his game today. I wouldn't expect anything more of him. He didn't give up a run. He kept getting out of these mini jams that he created. he wasn't bad. They weren't hitting him hard. So I think that's about what you can expect. But I'm just thinking, what is going on with Oryx that they have to start him in game two? You had a whole week
instead
off.
Instead of?
Here. Instead of other guys. I mean, there are a couple guys I would start before him.
And
I'm just thinking that they were going to focus on the home games. That was my idea. And the same goes for the Swallows. I wasn't sure who was going to start game one when they talked about Ogawa. I said, well, that makes sense. But who's going to start game two? And then when they go on the road, who's going to start? And it just seemed like both sides were willing to say, okay, we're going to do this in game two. We're going to send a guy out. And he's going to go a couple times through the order, and then we'll play it by ear the rest of the way. And I think that was the plan today. And I think that was the plan
for Oryx, because they took Yamasaki out without using a pinch hitter. So I think that was the plan. The other thing is he's been pitching out of the bullpen for the last month.
Yes.
Over a month. So
it's
I think they might have been concerned that, you know, that was basically they wanted him to go twice through the rotation. With Cy Snead, I think he probably would have stayed in the game. They were saying, and I think they were right on this, that when Hideki Nagaoka beat out a double play, you know, he stayed out of a double play for the third out in the fourth inning, Snead basically had a helmet on, and he was going to go back and pitch if there was a double play, but they stayed out of a double play and they brought up Shingo Kawabata to pinch hit.
Right.
So I think their plan was to keep him, but I thought Oryx's plan was fairly transparent. We're going to let Yamasaki swing the bat and we're going to let him go through the lineup twice.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, my issue isn't with that part. It's just with why aren't you not going with better pitchers? Because these games do matter, by the way. So that was just weird to me.
Yeah, so, that is weird. And all I can wonder is if somehow how Japanese baseball is when all the OBs, you know, the old boys get together and they're always given advice. You know, it's too many cooks spoil the broth. I wonder, you know, Tatsunori Hara never played with Nakajima, but I can just hear him going, listen, bud, I play against these Swallows a lot of times. And also in the post, the secret to success in the postseason is not using any starting pitchers at all.
And change second baseman every time you get a chance.
Well, no, I'm out of that phase now. I've been there, done that. I'm now in the postseason. What you want is five bullpen games.
All right. Well, we'll get them, because I think we're gonna have 3 days consecutive with game schedule, and it's at a dome stadium, so we don't have to worry about rainouts. So Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday in Osaka, and it should be fun. And I'm glad we're able to do what we haven't been able to do usually in Japan series times. We always had to guess, and so this is fun starting off the series with a weekend two set here in Tokyo, or one venue, and then we get the three games in the middle of the week and have a chance to wrap it up on Saturday. And I'll still pray for that to happen.
This tie kind of messed that up a little bit.
yeah. All right, let's make a seamless transition and talk about the draft that went down on Thursday, this past Thursday, and it's NPB's scattershot, haphazard, random draft that takes place every year. And Jim knows I dislike it. I dislike how it's set up and how they go about it. And I was sitting around thinking about how much I dislike the draft on Tuesday and Wednesday, and even Thursday, the day of. And I started to remember all these coaches I've spoken to through the years, and how their comments started to come back to me all of a sudden this year. For some reason, it was just this year. And I've talked to Frank Rampin. Remember him? He was with the local Marines. I didn't talk to Mike Brown specifically about the draft. Mike Brown, Nippon Ham's former pitching coach back in the day. Tom O'Malley with Hanchi. I remember talking to him about the draft when we were just shooting the breeze once before. Of course, Chunichi's Alonzo Powell. I spoke with him about the draft. And these guys have talked about how the teams basically don't even put some of the players' names on their draft board because other teams have talked to them and it seems like the player wants to go to that team.
It happens.
And so they're foreign guys. They're like, hey, look, this is competition. You go, it's a draft. You know, it's not a promise. It's not a promise ring. You don't say, I promise I'll marry you, you know, when we get old enough and I have a job and there's enough money and I can support a family and blah, blah. No, it's a draft. You come here, you get to work, Cinderella, and you do what I tell you. So,
yeah, Japan is quite a bit different from that.
It's bizarre. So, granted, this season, we talked about it last week, that there weren't really some outstanding gold jewel of the draft who was going to be out there, who was going to immediately going to be the media darling of the camp season and all that stuff. But there were a couple of good players out there who people wanted to, and actually, including the Giants, I believe, right? Mentioned ahead of time that they planned to draft these players. Yeah.
Nine teams, which I understand is, this is one thing I really don't pay attention to is who the teams say they're going to draft on in the first round.
Right.
I mean, the Fighters do that a lot, but some teams do and some teams don't. But people were commenting that nine is an extreme number.
Hmm. Well, it's to me, it's like an accordion, right? Everybody just folds into place and they do their part. And so we won't step on your shoes, you don't step on our shoes, and we all just fold up together and go home packed up with the
clothes that we brought. There is a bit of that, although the Fighters are famous for stepping on people's toes in the draft.
Good, good. There should be some of that. So on Thursday, two players, I guess the negotiating rights had to be decided by drawing, and that was right-handed pitcher Kosei Shoji, a college pitcher, whose rights went to Rakuten in a lottery, and they went up against Lotte, and they won that. And then Shogo Asano, a high schooler who slugged 68 home runs on that level, and the Yomiuri Giants had to go to a lottery with the Hanshin Tigers, and they came away with the negotiating rights. So that was about all for the TV drama, and then there was just a bunch. And I usually like to go through the draft, and I look and see who got the most pitchers and who got the most outfielders. And it occurred to me that in recent years, I guess in recent 10 to 15 to maybe 20 years, there really aren't a lot of quote-unquote outfielders who are being drafted. There's mostly pitchers and infielders, and then guys just happen to end up being put in the outfield because there's no room for them. I guess Akira Nao was the last kind of a biggish name of a player who experienced that right away, that there wasn't any room for him in the infield, so they just threw him in the outfield. But the Hiroshima Carp, I think, drafted a number of outfielders in this draft, but otherwise it was pretty much the same kind of a typical draft that everybody expects to see and experiences.
Yeah, it's pretty common that most of the top fielders, the position players who drafted higher, essentially shortstops, because they want guys who are A, fast and who have good throwing arms. But there were, you know, and that's pretty common. And I'm going to bring up somebody who did figure in the draft, which was in addition to the two guys you mentioned, I guess the other big name in the draft was Kota Yazawa from Nippon Sport Science University. And he's a big name because, and I'm not a big amateur guy, but in April, Samurai Japan manager Hideki Kuriyama was talking about this kid. He was going to watch him play, and he said, I wanted him to play in March against Taiwan. And obviously the reason you want this college player to play against Taiwan for the national team is as a placeholder because he's a two-way player. And he's really the first guy whoever went into Japan's draft, where it was clear that before the draft that he was going to end up as a two-way player. Because Shohei Ohtani, that was something that happened after the draft. That was a, you know, what can we do? You know, how can we sweeten this deal for you so you don't run off to the United States and sign with an MLB team? So that was after the fact. And there was another, of course, one of my favorite two-way prospects is Hanshin Tigers pitcher Junya Nishi, who the Tigers said, two-way player, are you kidding? We don't court controversy with Hanshin Tigers. Who are you kidding us?
We don't court so, it just sets up shop in our house. And
well, you know, yeah, I mean, the manager said, oh yeah, I'm really interested. And then after you talked to the front office, they said, are you kidding? we don't do that stuff. So Koji Ozawa went to the Fighters, and he was very happy to go there, of course, because they have a history with Shohei Ohtani. And one of the so that was one interesting thing in the draft. And the other interesting thing in the draft was the Fighters' third pick, who was a 29-year-old Gosuke Kato, seen with in AAA Syracuse with the New York Mets. And he played six MLB games. He's played six MLB games this summer with the Toronto Blue Jays. Now, Kato because he's a Japanese citizen, he was born in America and grew up in America, but his parents are both Japanese, and he retained his Japanese citizenship. Because he's a Japanese citizen, he cannot play in NPB unless he goes through the draft. It doesn't matter what country he's a resident of. So
right.
Japan's draft is quite different from MLB's draft. MLB's draft in a number of ways, and that's one. So that's kind of interesting to see what he'll do. And of course, he's interesting because when we talked about shortstops and arms, I remember Kato made news in 2013 when he was drafted by the New York Yankees as they're in the second round because he was
a teenager, right?
No, you know, he was 20. I think he was 20. He was going to UCLA.
Oh, I thought he was a teenager. Okay. I'm misremembering.
He was 19. Maybe he was coming out of high school. Yeah, he was coming out of high school, but he was going to go to UCLA if he wasn't drafted. And they took him in the second round. And somebody said it was the first time in like 18 or 19 years that a second baseman had gone in the second round, as high as the second round. And the reason for that is they're second basemen because they don't have throwing arms. You know, they don't have shortstop caliber arms. So that's why no second baseman never go in the second round. But so that was the draft. And the other one is the South Bank Hawks. Well, let me
say one thing about Kato is that I remember seeing him on the news. I remember hearing him speak Japanese and thinking, oh, wait a second, something's off about his Japanese or different about his Japanese. Doesn't sound like the guys who speak here. So, I'd be really interested in seeing if we can get him to come on the show because I'm sure his English is really good.
Oh, sure.
And yeah, I did see that, and I did notice that he was I had forgotten it was the Fighters who got him. And then I think in one instance I said, oh, the Fighters, but they don't really need him. But yes, they do. They could probably, if he's really good, they could probably use him. So, but you know, he's definitely going to have to play his way into that lineup. But I think he originally was a shortstop.
In high school.
So that's what I remember about him. Okay, go ahead.
So the other thing was the SoftBank Hawks picked 14 developmental players in the developmental draft, which follows.
As they want to do, yeah. Yeah, they always collect them, right?
Yep, they got a factory going on, and the Hanshin Tigers picked their token developmental player. Everybody picked a developmental player this year. I think it's second year that it's actually happened. But most of the teams, I think the Swallows also only picked one. So it's basically the teams that are willing to give players opportunities and actually spend money on their development. Because, you know, as you've said before with people you've talked to, and the Hanshin Tigers have publicly said the same thing, that having a third team and having a lot of developmental players requires extra costs. And if you're not going to spend the money, there's no point to have the guys. Yeah, so the whole thing is that if you see, what I've noticed is that if you see teams drafting a huge number of developmental players, it means that they're trying to look at the long haul and develop players. And this was reflected. They had one of the sports papers did a survey, the evening newspapers, the evening scandal sheets kind of. And they did a survey. They talked to an unknown number of draft candidates and asked them, which team do you want to be drafted by and which team don't you want to be drafted by?
Mm.
And the only thing they said was the most common team to be that for draft candidates who wanted to go to was the SoftBank Hawks. And despite the fact that they have so many guys and you've really got to fight for survival there, they said the SoftBank Hawks have a reputation for actually trying to make their kids better.
Mm, which is what I was going to say. I mean, if you're a competitor and you play sports, you want to know right away, well, can I play on this level? Can I compete? And the only way to find that out is to go and compete against some of the best. Now, maybe you might not have success at that point and you can go somewhere else and find some success, but you're going to know at least. Mm-hmm. And you know, a lot of times you want to go second, so you know what the score is that you have to beat in that kind of respect. So you get an idea of what you have to do to get better. And it makes you focus on those weaknesses or on getting better. Not necessarily, even if you fail, it doesn't mean that you fail completely. Just means that you have more work to do. So, I totally understand that.
I think the other thing about the Hawks, although the competition level is very high, the Hawks are also a little bit more of a meritocracy when it comes to their players. Than
not so political, yeah.
Well, that's the thing. They get guys who perform really well on their farm team. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter as much on the Hawks how well connected they are within the front office and among the scouting department. It doesn't matter how many people, how many advocates they have. But in many teams, minor leaguers can, you know, if you're a minor league hitter, you can just be too good for the league you're in and get stuck there because people within the team don't particularly like you. With the Hawks, that's less of a thing. So there is that thing. And the team that players are less likely to want to go to was kind of a surprise because another reason that the kids picked the Hawks was that they are really focused on winning. You know, winning is important there. And so if you do succeed and you're good enough, you'll have a chance to win some, you know, you can win some championships with the Hawks. And the team that was considered the least favorite was the Nippon Ham Fighters. And one of the reasons was they seemed to be less interested in winning from their recent results. And also they have a manager who seems more interested in what he's doing than in building a winning team. That was what some of the kids said.
Yeah.
Shinjo's performances, you know, he seems to be a little bit stuck up with what he wants, if that's probably a pejorative, and I apologize.
Well, yeah, I think if you go back to the beginning of the season, I think that's what I mentioned a lot of the time. So I don't think that's anything new. So yeah,
and they mentioned, the other things they mentioned was that he doesn't seem to like a set lineup, and he just likes to, you know, he moves everybody around all the time. And
yeah, Tommy Tinker, yeah.
Yeah, yes. whether that's fair or not, I don't know, because, you know, the Fighters being what they were and what he was asked to do, you know, sometimes the manager has a mandate to do certain things. And I think his mandate was in order to be entertaining, was to invigorate the players and give guys opportunities. And then he said, if you're hitting 200, it's because you're not trying hard enough.
I think the mandate was lower the bar for this year so that when we go into our new dome, you know, the expectations will be easier to meet.
Yeah.
And entertain.
Yes, yeah. Those two things. Then I said, if I give you 20 at bats and you're hitting 200, you're probably not good enough. And I thought, wow, it's like Alex Ramirez all over again.
Sorry, well, Alex. Yeah. All right. Well,
so that was the draft.
That was the draft. Yeah. It was there wasn't a lot of drama this year. We didn't have anybody open the envelope and celebrate, all to find out that they actually didn't win the lottery, that they lost the lottery. So we didn't have any of that kind of things, Mr. Mitsuru Manaka. But anyway, it was a draft and it happened. Like I said, it's bizarre. I don't like the way it goes down here. I would like to see teams push each other and go for, I think it just all has to do with money. And I think even in the draft, the low budget teams are staying low budget and the big market teams are going for the big pricey ones. But anyway, we'll talk more about this in the off season. Let's go to fielding questions. All right. So we got this one from Rock Fan via Twitter, and he said, a quick high heat for you two. The Fighters' new stadium looks great in the pictures, but any idea how it might play? Are they making it a hitter's park, shorter than normal outfield walls, maybe? Or are they evaluating the cavernous Sapporo Dome? And is there anything else of note that you know? Thanks. So, Rock Fan, I was listening to a radio broadcast. In fact, it was the last regular season game at Sapporo Dome, that broadcast on the radio. And I heard one of the color analysts, I can't remember what his name was, but it was a guy I'm not that familiar with. But he said that he had gone to the dome and he had seen it. And that the walls are going to be lower and the ball is going to carry okay. And then I thought about it and I thought, what is okay? You know, okay, that statement is relative because what's okay for one guy might not be okay for another guy. And what is okay for you, okay for the players. So I think that's kind of relative. I don't know what that is. I think it's all speculation until the teams start playing in the facility and that we get an understanding of what it is when there's actual competition going on as opposed to batting practice. I remember when Nagoya Dome was being built, and I don't know if I ever told you this, Jim, that my paper that I was publishing in Nagoya.
You have told me.
That we got to do a tour while they were building it. So we went in and we got to take pictures before the artificial turf was down and everything, before the seats were put in. They only really had the roof on. And then later on, when they did put the artificial turf down, they invited us back and we went there and I saw Alonzo Powell and he said, man, the ball doesn't carry in this thing, man. And he told me right away that it was not going to be a hitter's park. But I don't know that anybody knew that until they put the stadium together, except for the high fences that they had out there in the outfield wall. So the fences, color analyst said, are going to be lower than the ones in Sapporo Dome. That's all I know for right now. Jim.
Well, yeah, I think there are a lot of pitchers who think the ball carries just fine in Sapporo Dome. So,
as you said,
it's relative, but I believe that the fighters were never happy with Sapporo Dome for a numfold laundry list of reasons, mostly because they couldn't fill it up often enough because it doesn't really capture the energy of the fans very well unless they're all jumping up and down and they have to tell them to stop when Atsunori Inaba's batting because the place vibrated like, you know, it was like a trampoline.
It was shaking, man.
It was vibrating
like it was cute. It was it was shaking. Yeah. It was rocking. It was literally rocking.
It was indeed because it was like a big fiberglass. The seats are like a big fiberglass potato chip, and you jump up and down on one side, and it reverberates through the ballpark. But they do want, they wanted a park where the fans are close to the action and where it's probably a little, it's close to a neutral park or, you know, something where, you know, offense happens because offense is easier to sell.
Sure.
The other thing is that the Fighters, so I think they've taken a lot of things into account, but I expect it to be a fairly offense-friendly place. Now, whether that's going to matter or not is, you know, my big question is, are the Fighters building this park so that they can sell condominiums around the park, which it would be the MLB approach to having a new stadium. Let's sell condominiums and then pay the minimum for players so that we can rake in whatever money. But unfortunately for Japanese teams, they don't get these huge MLB advanced media contracts that basically pay them, you know, $60 million to start the season. So that might, you know, tanking might not be the sweet path to success for Nippon Ham and their shiny new ballpark. So I hope not, but they will make a lot more money than they were making in Sapporo Dome. And that's the main thing. It's not how much the ball carries. It's how much their, you know, ticket receipts and concessions and souvenirs and advertising revenues carry is the main thing they're interested in.
The love of the game, baby.
It is not the baseball game. It is 100% the love of the game, and
not the baseball game.
Yeah, well, well, games are relative too.
I love it. All right, nice way to wrap it up. All right, thank you for the question, Rock Fan. Anyone else that has a question, hit us up on Twitter at JBW Podcast with the hashtag High Heat. Send questions via email to ykyujohn@gmail.com. Leave us a note on our Facebook page. We will talk to you next week. Look for us on iTunes and Google Podcasts. Enjoy your Japan series.
Yep, and see you at the ballpark. Hopefully not in Game 9.
Follow the hosts on Twitter at JBW Podcast and at JBallAllen. Submit your questions with hashtag High Heat and listen for an answer in an upcoming episode.